You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 100, by Rudolf Steiner, a book entitled True Knowledge of the Christ. I have finished the first cycle in this book, Theosophy and Rosicrucianism, and am beginning the second cycle. This is, in fact, the 16th part of this book. I'm calling it maybe the 16th lecture. It is, in fact, lecture one of this small cycle on the Gospel of John. This is given in Basel on the 16th of November, 1907, translated by Anna Moise. Someone taking a careful look at cultural life will find that many souls are in deep conflict. People are in their earliest youth presented with not one but two philosophies of life, one through religious instruction, the other through natural science. As a result, they are in doubt about the correctness of religious teaching from the very beginning. We might think that theosophy is intended to be yet another religious belief system. That is not the case, however. Theosophy is not a new religion, nor a new sect. It is more than religion. In these lectures, the aim is to show, with the aid of theosophy, the significance of a religious document such as the Gospel of John. A look at this Gospel is particularly apt to show how theosophy relates to religious documents in general. It helps us to understand the religious streams that exist in the world. Someone who is familiar with theosophy takes Christianity as it is for a fact that is of the greatest significance for the whole cultural and spiritual life of humanity. However, it is impossible in modern cultural life to plumb the depths of Christianity. Theosophy is the instrument, the means, without which nothing can be done. Using this instrument, we can enter deeply into the wisdom of the religious documents. We might compare theosophy with philology. Philology also makes it possible for us to study the religious documents. Theosophy does, however, take us into the spirit of these documents. Euclidean geometry is properly interpreted not by someone who merely knows Greek, but by someone with knowledge of the facts of geometry. Theosophy is not meant to be a new religion for modern humanity, but the means of bringing Christianity closer to them again in its true content. Christianity is the most sublime of all religions. All other religions merely point toward Christianity. It is the religion of all our future, and none other will take its place. The source spring of truth bubbling forth in it is inexhaustible. It is so powerful that it will reveal ever new aspects to itself as humanity continues to evolve. Theosophy is intended to show us Christianity in a new aspect. We can approach religious documents in four different ways. Firstly, from the point of view of naive belief, with people going by the actual words they are given. Many people are unable to reconcile this approach with modern thinking. They then take the second approach, critique, doubt, rejection. This is the approach of clever, enlightened people who consider religious truth to be something which has been overcome. Many of these enlightened people investigate further and find that these religious documents are, after all, rich in content. They win through to the third approach, which is that of symbolism. They produce many or few interpretations, depending on their cast of mind and their knowledge. Many former freethinkers in Germany have won through to this approach. Theosophy finally offers a fourth approach. One learns to take their religious documents literally again. We will have notable examples of this in our study of the Gospel of John. The Gospel of John has very much a place of its own among the four Gospels. Those of Matthew, Mark, and Luke provide a historical picture of Jesus of Nazareth. The Gospel of John is considered to be an apotheosis, a marvelous poetic work. It contradicts the other three Gospels on a number of occasions. But those contradictions are so evident that we cannot assume that the early defenders of the Gospel of John did not take note of them. At present, the Gospel of John is considered to be the least credible. The reason lies in the materialistic mentality of our time. Human beings grew materialistic in their feelings in the 19th century, and in consequence of this, also in their thinking. People form their opinions on the basis of their feelings. Materialism is a philosophy of life which is put forward not only in the works of Büchner, Morschat, and Vogt. Even people who want to take a certain academic position as exegetes of the scriptures do so in a wholly materialistic way. An example would be the dispute between Karl Vogt and Professor Wagner at Göttingen University. This dispute was published in the title Augsburger Zeitung newspaper, and it was Karl Vogt who gained the complete victory. Wagner stood for the existence of the soul, but did so in a wholly materialistic way. As our theologians are also materialistically minded, the three Gospels of the three synoptists suit them better, for with them materialistic exegesis is permissible. It goes against the grain in materialistic thinking to accept a spirit that is vastly superior to all humanity. It is more to their taste to see Jesus of Nazareth as a noble individual, the simple man from Nazareth. In the Gospel of John, it is quite impermissible to see in Jesus only the principles which are also to be found in any other human being. The soul of the Christ and the body of Jesus is something completely different. The Gospel of John shows us the Christ not only as an outstanding human being, but also as a spirit that embraces the whole earth. Translated not literally, but in the spirit, the first 14 verses of the Gospel of John read, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. Through him everything entered into existence, and without him nothing entered into existence. What existed was life in him, and the life was the light of mankind. And the light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not taken hold of it." There entered into existence a man sent out from God. His name was John. He came as a witness, to bear witness to the light, so that everyone might believe through him. He was not the light, but should bear witness to the light, the true light, who enlightens every human being coming into the world. He was in the world. Through him the world entered into existence, and the world was not aware of him. He came into his own, and those who were his own did not receive him. To all who accepted him he gave the authority for their existence as children of God. For those who believe in his name, it was not of blood streams, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of mortal man, but of God that they were born. In the flesh, the Word entered into existence and made his dwelling among us, and we beheld the glory of his revelation, revealed as an only born from his Father, full of grace and truth. Close quote. For John, truth, aletheia, equals manas. Devotion, charis, equals buddhi. Wisdom, sophia, equals atman. The very first word is taken as an abstract term by modern people. The beginning is seen as an abstract start or beginning. To grasp the real meaning of this term, you have to bring to mind what was taught in Dionysius the Areopagite's occult school. Mineral, plant, animal, and human being are the developmental sequence of entities that need a physical body. Above them are others that exist without one. These are the angels, archangels, principalities or rulers, powers or authorities, virtues or strongholds, dominions or lordships, thrones or ophanim, cherubim, seraphim, and beyond. The principalities, or first beginnings, are real entities, therefore. The name was given to spirits, which at the beginning of our world evolution had developed as far as humanity will go at the Vulcan stage. If we consider the first verse, quote, in the beginning was the word, logos, close quote, we could picture the situation by using the following analogy. Before we utter it, the word lives in us as thought. When it is uttered, waves are created in the air around us. If we think of some process in which these waves are frozen, we would see the words drop to the ground as forms and configurations. We would see the creative power of the word with our own eyes. The word is creative now. In future, this will be the case to a much greater degree. People today have organs that will only gain their full significance in future times, whilst others are already decadent. The latter include the reproductive organs, the former, the heart and the larynx, both of which are only in the early stages of their evolution. The heart is an involuntary muscle, in spite of being striated, like all voluntary muscles. This striation gives a hint that the heart is in transition from an involuntary to a voluntary organ. The larynx is destined to be the human reproductive organ in the far distant future, however paradoxical this may seem. Today, human beings can use speech to convert their thoughts into waves in the air. One day they will be able to use the word to create their own image. The principalities had this creative power at the beginning of our present world evolution, and may thus rightly be considered to be divine spirits. When world evolution began, a divine word was spoken, and this has become mineral, plant, animal, and human being. The end of Lecture 1.